Thank you, James. I'm going to ask people who want to comment or ask questions to line up. And while they're doing that, I want to say a word about some of the issues that James has brought up, because I think he's left us with a bit of a puzzle. We did have this precedent of Dayton, which had been brought about by bombing. The people who had done Dayton were now trying to do Kosovo. So why didn't it work? It didn't work, in my view, and I admit to having been a participant observer at the time, it didn't work because they'd misunderstood what had happened with the bombing of Bosnia. The bombing of Bosnia, which had destroyed the effectiveness of the Bosnian Serb army, had led, it wasn't the Bosnian Serb army that concerned Milosevic. That belonged to his rival, Karadzic. What concerned Milosevic was that he thought, and maybe he was right, that 600,000 Serbs would walk out of Bosnia if the war continued. He had reason to worry about that. 180,000, 200,000 Croatian Serbs had walked out of Croatia just a couple of months before, partly at his behest. And they represented, or so it was thought at the time, a threat to his hold on power. And it was logical for him to conclude, and I think he did conclude, that 600,000 Serbs walking out of Bosnia would seriously threaten his hold on power. And that's why he came to Dayton, not the recalcitrant Milosevic portrayed in Dick Holbrooke's book, but suing for peace. And it was quite clear that he was determined to come away from Dayton with a peace in Bosnia. Why didn't it work in Kosovo? It didn't work in Kosovo, it seems to me, for a number of reasons, but not the least of which was there weren't nearly as many Kosovo Serbs to walk out and threaten his hold on power. There weren't, he had much better control over the situation. He'd learned how to absorb displaced people into Serbia without allowing a threat to his hold on power. And the real threat to his hold on power by that time was if he gave in to the deployment of international forces in Kosovo. So this has to be thought of, it seems to me, in terms of Milosevic's primary concern, which had nothing to do with refugees, displaced people. It had to do with his own hold on power, and it worked once for good reasons, and it didn't work the second time for good reasons, but the people who brought you Dayton had misunderstood what had happened at Dayton.
And I think that's what I was, I just differ on the methodology of getting there, but the same point. Dayton, he wanted out of the war. Kosovo, he wanted the war.
Please.
My name is Zoran Hodger. I'm International Monetary Fund. I just want to make a technical comment, and it relates to the organization of the whole thing. I am sorry to say that the hearing from the speakers was very poor, and that would especially Mr. Cao, I don't think that we more than a couple of rows could hear what he was saying. And I think this is a pity. This is really a pity. And I would think that Mr. Server and the organization should take care of that. Somebody should sit in the back from the employees and make sure that everybody can hear what it was done. Because I couldn't hear almost anything what Mr. Cao said. Thank you.
Thank you. I we do have somebody in the back. I've seen him leave the room several times to try to get things fixed. And I'm afraid they're still not completely fixed. I would just urge all speakers, including those who comment, to speak directly into the microphone. Roy.
Thank you, Dan. Roy Stafford, National War College. I have the impossible question. Was Kosovo avoidable by nonviolence. Given that over time, after autonomy was granted in 1974, the Albanians increasingly chafed at that autonomy is not going far enough. The Serbs chafed at it as going too far. Given the personalities involved, could this have been avoided? Could a solution have been reached that would have been acceptable, if not pleasing, to all parties?
I'm going to take three at a time, so go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Georgi Stefanovic, from University of Toronto. My question is for Professor James Gall. Professor Gall, thank you very much. I very much appreciate that you, I think you're really making an effort to have a balanced treatment of this issue. What I want from my moderate Serbian point of view, just to ethnically self-identify. The only issue that I think you did not really address, and I thought is relevant for this, is the issue of ethnic cleansing of Serbian minority in Kosovo by Albanian extremists following the arrival of the NATO troops. Because many of these people who were ethnically cleansed in this period are still living in the refugee camps in Serbia, very often under absolutely awful conditions, and their continued suffering is unfortunately being politically instrumentalized by the far-right Serbian Radical Party, which is threatening the democratic transition in Serbia. So this is a question which is not just of historical relevance. I think that NATO did considerably improve its reputation in the eyes of many people in Serbia because it did manage to prevent the attempted pogroms in March of last year against the remaining Serbs in Kosovo. But still, to me, the unanswered question is, how is it possible that an ethnic minority could have been ethnically cleansed in the presence of the NATO troops, which supposedly came to the region in order to stop ethnic cleansing? Thank you very much.
Please.
Next one as well?
Okay. Yeah.
I think we're going to overload Professor Gao probably here. I'm John Savalas is my name, and I'm formerly with the U.S. Defense Department. In fact, I was in the Pentagon at the time of the Kosovo crisis in 99, and then I was over in Albania working on the refugee operation Shining Hope, and then back and forth in Kosovo a number of times afterward. And question I wanted to pose, it sort of brings together some of the issues from this morning, I think, with this one. From the level we were seeing things, which admittedly was very micro, it all seemed to be about immediate crisis response, averting a humanitarian disaster, and so on. I'd like to know, in the course of your research for this project, to what degree do you feel the people who were shaping the U.S. and NATO response to this were aware of the more overarching, bigger, long-term issues about final status, national identity, et cetera, both in coming up with Rambouillet and then in coming up with the settlement right after the war? And a sort of related piece of it, you had alluded to a number of the causative factors or the immediate triggers before the war. And I was wondering if you might just speak briefly about to what degree or how important you felt were the reports about the Operation Horseshoe, the German General Staff input on that, and to what degree you thought that was critical factor in part of the intervention. That's it.
I'm tempted first to turn to Ilber and wonder whether was Kosovo avoidable by nonviolence. That is, was the could we have avoided war if violent rebellion had not pushed aside nonviolent rebellion in Kosovo?
I don't think the war happened because of the rebellion. I think war happened actually because of 1989, because the way Milosevic wanted to handle the disintegration of Yugoslav drama, not just of Kosovo. So I think if Milosevic will, or different kind of political elite in Serbia will accept the reality of the existing constitution and structure of Yugoslavia, if that will be accepted as a way to have a long-term political perspective in which dialogue will be there, I think the conflict will never happen. I don't think that the Kosovars were opt for a military solution for a number of reasons and very practical one.
Dusan?
Yeah. In history, it's really hard to discuss the fact. The fact is that the war escalated 1999. That's first. Secondly, the fact is that there was the first military NATO intervention in Europe. The next fact is that was only one NATO intervention in which all member states participated. Some leaders of NATO told about the credibility of NATO. And that's my point. Myself, I was involved many, many years, starting from 89, in so-called dialogue, Albanian-Serbian dialogue. When I am now summarizing what we made at that time, I could say, that, first of all, that nobody influential, was interested for Kosovo until 94. That's first. Until that time, only some Europeans were dealing with the issue, talking about autonomy, blah, blah, blah. After 94, we were Americans actively involved, NGOs and others. But Kosovo indeed was not on agenda, including Dayton Agreement, Dayton Peace Conference. It's come so late on agenda for international community. And that's first. The second, the policies managing by the local people, politicians, were directed to the status quo story because they were not able to manage the situation. They finished with the war. And my last is, it's my warning, before coming in States, I was traveling around Kosovo, Macedonia, Albania. And I could say only what I saw on the ground is politicians who are not ready to take responsibility. And it's not excluded that in the end they will call militaries to intervene. My question is, what is indeed, exit strategy of NATO, which is political exit strategy for the Kosovo? I'm not talking about Bosnia. I'm talking about Kosovo, because not oil there, not gas, not strategical interests. And I did not see the plan B from the political leadership of both sides. And I saw only military people preparing their soldiers to act if it happened something in the end of May, beginning of June. That's the point is, if you're analyzing, I'm not expert like James, but if you're analyzing the policy, especially the policy of European Union, we will see in the end only NATO, military side of the NATO is acting.
Julie Mertis wanted to add that, yes, war in Kosovo was avoidable, but only if an international power responded earlier to the nonviolent movement there. I would add a personal word here as well. In late 97, I went to the powers that be in the State Department and said I wanted to work on Kosovo. I knew that war was ahead. I'd been sitting there in intelligence and research watching it happen, and I said, I just want to work on Kosovo, see if we could avoid the worst there. And they pondered this question for 24 hours. And mind you, this is late 97, came back to me and said, I couldn't do that. And I said, why can't I do that? They said, because having a senior officer working on Kosovo would attract too much attention to the issue. A year and a half later, we were at war over Kosovo. So I think it is fair to say that the international community made an exceedingly concerted effort to ignore Kosovo for a long time. James, you have several other questions to answer.
Well, first of all, I'm going to continue as a Julie impressionist. And I'm trying to speak over the microphone because I was consciously trying to speak into the microphone earlier because, apologies, but I was trying to speak into the microphone because there had been one person sitting at the back earlier on and having already registered a comment about the difficulty of hearing. I was trying to do that. And the trouble with the microphone, if you just speak out, it's much easier and ignore the microphone, which is what I'm trying to do now. But the microphone is very off-putting because it lures you into a sense of this thing is there and it's going to help. Now, what I'm going to do... I'm now going to continue the Julie impression because she subsequently passed a note and a few other comments and whispered some things to me. So what I'm... Right now, I'm Julie. Yeah. On the issue of revenge ethnic cleansing of Serbs in Kosovo, she wants to say she agrees this is a hugely important issue and one that somewhere probably needs to be addressed. Secondly, to say never underestimate the incompetence of some of the troops in Kosovo. You'd probably say that generally for any troops anywhere. Yeah, however good they are, there's always that potential for incompetence. And she was there in Kosovo in the fall, and it became unclear. Two things became clear. The first was that Serbs don't want to return to Kosovo, for very good reasons, I should say. And the second is that there also needs to be some discussion about compensation relating to that. And in that context, one of the things she whispered was that for the Albanians there, Serbs simply don't exist anymore. They're not part of, they're not part of the imagination. They're not part of the discourse. That I'm guessing, yeah, this was in the election campaign. Yeah, it just didn't feature as an issue. Something I would agree with very strongly. Julie says the politicians, this is the Kosovo Albanian political leadership, needs to take responsibility. And one of the things which has been missing, I think we would both agree on this, and going back to the events of March last year, well, I'm not sure whether we agree on what happened in March last year, but I actually think they did take responsibility, some of them, but they took responsibility for organising what happened in March. Whereas I think both of us agree that they should be taking responsibility for dealing with what happened as a subsequently for taking responsibility and addressing it and cooperating and trying to deal with it. Is that a fair representation? Okay, thanks. Now, on the other questions, and it's always difficult to be an individual, but in some sense trying to be aware of the sensitivities of a collective venture. I'm going to be an individual more than part of the collective, I think. Was anything over Kosovo possible without violence? I think the answer is highly, highly unlikely. Theoretically, it was possible, but I think what Dan mentioned, one of the issues involved, there would be a set of other circumstances that would have to have changed, were unlikely to change. But it doesn't mean to say it was impossible, just it would have taken a set of things to be other than they were for it to happen. Back to the question on the ethnic cleansing of Kosovo Serbs after NATO arrived. Well, the simple part of that is that the mission to deal with US NATO Kosovo 1998-99 was Rambouillet, a diktat, a pretext for bombing, just doesn't go that far. That it should be an issue dealt with somewhere in some part of the framework, I think, is a reasonable proposition. Whether this is the place for it, I'm not convinced. That wasn't the mission that we had. But that said, I would go back before March last year, because I would say, I know British troops from the very outset were involved in protecting Kosovo Serbs in their apartments, actually deploying troops as far as available, just protecting buildings, protecting individual apartments, protecting individual old people. So not only is it a question of underestimating the potential incompetence, but also the fact that there was a degree of competence there. But no matter, with the best will in the world, no matter how much you're doing, there's probably always going to be something that can be done, that's something that doesn't get done in those circumstances. What degree... What's the other question?
The awareness of the longer-term issues among policymakers.
Well, and also reference to so-called Operation Horseshoe. On the latter, I wouldn't get too hung up on Horseshoe itself. I don't think the operations in March were Horseshoe Plus or whatever, if they were anything. They were not the Horseshoe. There was something called Horseshoe floating around, and somebody picked up on this. I'd be fairly content to accept that. And that whatever it was that was out there was clearly shaping thinking about what to do. That was there was the understanding that a campaign was going to begin in late March, and there was a sense of getting there, if possible, before it began. and being ready to address it otherwise. Were they aware of, were people involved aware of bigger, wider issues? Yes, they were. And I think not only simply crisis management. Some of the things that have been talked about were all, somebody said in response to Ratchak, and in preparing the paper, one of the issues that's come up, which I wouldn't have put so much attention to, but it's there in the paper, is about Ratchak on January the 15th, 1999, because this was seen as being a big motivating element. But I was in D.C. at that time, and I'd left London with troops already packing their kit bags, and people there already strategically planning to go to Rambouillet to try to get an agreement and to have the troops deployed to prevent all of this happening. Yeah, and so from where I was and from what I could tell, there were people giving considerable strategic advanced thought to this and to being ready. Now, I'm going to cease to be me again and represent Julie. She's saying that the Kosovars tend to be in agreement that this is on the violence issue again.
Yeah,
that violence would have broken, that violence will break loose again. Presumably more of the ethnic cleansing of Serbs if the UK and the US pull out of Kosovo, which is giving no confidence to any of the others who are represented there. Exactly. Well, this is rather like letting, it's kind of rather like General Mladic getting away when he dipped into Bosnia last year. I'm sure if it had been British troops, he wouldn't have got away, but Italian troops forgot that there are two ends to a tunnel. Never underestimate the incompetence.
I had the opportunity to be on the task force on Kosovo in 98 and later in 99 and visited Kosovo on a number of occasions through those 2 years. And let me start by saying, Dusan, you're absolutely right. There was a military plan, a military option, but no civilian plan and no civilian option. They negotiated a civilian plan with Milosevic, but they never carried it out. And it was tragic because we all saw it coming. The second thing that I have to say is that Dan is absolutely right when he said that in 97 that he wanted to work on Kosovo, and at that time we were saying, let's solve the problem in Bosnia and Kosovo will be dealt with later, as if you can put these things in a row and delay the process because it's not convenient to deal with it.
Please.
I'm Nancy Iris. I'm from the Department of State, from the Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. And I was just in the region. I was in Serbia and in Bosnia. And while people may have not wanted to return last fall, I can report, from having spoken with individual families myself and the agencies who are returning them, that there are indeed people who are returning. And I would say that there's actually a nascent optimism, if you will, about return currently. I'd be interested in the panel's speculation, however, about what the result would be or the outcome in terms of movement of people concerning final status, whether they would see, what kind of movements they would see, depending on which way final status of Kosovo would go.
What kind of percentage of people wanting to return were you perceiving?
I didn't talk to large numbers, so I don't know percent, but I mean, some people do want to return.
Sure.
And as I said, I felt in all sectors, in talking with government officials, talking with the agencies, talking with NGOs and the IOs, that there is a rising small optimism right now.
Can I also, on Julie's behalf, ask where were they? It's a question, were they in camps?
No, they were not in camps. No, I mean, there are very few camps in any case. But both, a few people in collective centers, but no, really all over, from Novi Sad to...
Right, all over. That was the other question, was
right.
Were they all over?
And people returning to western Kosovo, some of the more difficult areas to return people, starting, one family. But that, at least right now, there is slight movement in that direction. But as I said, I'd be interested in speculation of the panel. Thank you.
Yes, I sometimes think about how discouraged we were for the first few years after Dayton about returns, and yet that's turned into a substantial success story. I'm not sure the same will be true of Kosovo, but it is true that it's hard to know in those first couple of years. Please.
Last shall be first, and the first shall be last. I was going to conclude 4 points I'd like to make with the question of return, but I think if that's the current
tell
discussion.
Tell us who you are before Frederick you get
Frederick Peterson, Senior Policy Advisor for Congressman Tancredo and the House International Relations Committee.
Welcome.
Thank you. The question of return, it should not be surprising at all that there would be reluctance to return to a situation that is continues to be unsafe and uncertain at very best. To leave camps in which one finds safety and security, although inadequacies in many other human areas, to go to a situation where one finds the same inadequacies on the human side, and yet an almost utter lack of safety and assurance of and predictions of future violence should not be surprising to anyone. I think that if in questions of return we should look at a much larger context of return, choose a point in history, in recent history, where there was legitimacy of status of peoples on both sides, in the Albanian side that have freely flowed back and forth across the borders, and on the Serbian side as well, and grant status to vote to people given that particular date and point in time. That's one way that this could be addressed. I think that it is also a rather glib and inaccurate and historically inaccurate and dangerous for us to draw conclusions from a political situation that occurred domestically here in the United States, which gave rise to, at that time, freely acknowledged in the movies, in popular culture, as well as in diplomatic circles, that precipitated U.S. movement in an area that would not have happened in all likelihood had that domestic political situation not interplayed with the international at the time. It is highly unlikely that NATO or Europe would have acted but for that domestic U.S. political situation. I offer that as an observation.
What specifically are you referring to?
The Clinton difficulties and the administration here at the time. The title of the movie, I think, was Wag the Dog, right? And the allegories that I think were very well taken at the time. Not to say that actions were right or not right, but simply that they would be less likely to have occurred had not that situation encouraged them. Also would like to have you address the situation where the NATO forces, KFOR, for whatever reason, and their explanations for it, did fail to anticipate and fail to adequately, in fact, in many cases, fail to respond at all to the events of last March, causing catastrophic effects upon the world inheritance of culture, as well as destruction of lives and property. It is, we saw the outrage of the world when the Taliban, and in fact a tipping of the balance on the part of world opinion significantly against the Taliban, when they had the temerity to destroy the great Buddhas, and yet a failure of response, almost total failure of response to the activities of last March, when over a period of days we saw NATO troops who had assumed the responsibility assumed a responsibility to protect lives and property, stand back and allow lives and property to be destroyed in front of their eyes. This was utterly unacceptable, and it's something that can never be tolerated again. The failure to anticipate, failure to enforce the presence of their own power and the assumptions of responsibility of that power should be unacceptable and part of any lessons to be learned from this. An inevitability of future violence has been talked about. An inevitability of violence in the past under the Milosevic regime and under whatever changes could be made in the status of Kosovo. When one assumes or requires certain ends, violence may inevitably become inevitable. One must question the reasonableness of ends of policy before one can wring one's hands and rend one's clothing to the heavens about inevitabilities either way. So we and all sides must have reasonable ends before we can expect rational implementations of policies and avoidance of violence, which I think is certainly should be in the expectation of everyone at least here present. Thank you.
Thank you. One more, and then
I'll be very short because this is my second time. But I could not resist to ask this question. It's mainly addressed to. Okay, here is this better?
Yes.
It's mainly addressed to. I have to stand on my toes, though.
Tilt it down.
Like this. It's mainly addressed to Mr. Server and Mr. Gao, and it is about Milosevic agreeing in Bosnia because he would have been faced with the exodus of 600,000 Serbs and how it was different from Kosovo. And I find it somewhat conflicting with when I read, for example, the account by Richard Holbrooke, or when I see the accounts in the newspapers at the time of the Dayton, because I had the impression that the major source of pressure at Dayton was the side of a government, which basically had to accept the division of Bosnia. There was never a plan to what Sada would call liberate all of Bosnia, because it was the same plan that was in 94 negotiated by Europe and now accepted by Americans, and that was and the whole bombing campaign was basically bringing the Bosnian Serbs aboard by telling them, look, we don't know how you're going to give up a part of a territory because they control 70% of territory. So I had the impression that Milosevic was the main peacemaker, perceived as the main peacemaker. That's when I read, for example, Holbrooke's account. And I again bring this question of the need to have an examination of American narratives and how they change over time.
Very good. We have quite a few questions on the table about U.S. politics, failure of KFOR to execute its responsibilities, anticipate and react in March, the question of whether reasonable ends are necessary to avoid violence, and the question of, let me put it as, was Milosevic the main peacemaker at Dayton as portrayed in Dick Holbrooke's book? There are a number of other questions I think I missed taking notes on, but I'll go through the panel. I think.
Sorry, Dan, surely Dick Holbrooke was presented as the main peacemaker in his book.
I had my doubts about whether Milosevic was the main peacemaker, but we can say something, I think, about that narrative and how it portrays Milosevic and whether it's accurate or not. I think that's a legitimate question. I guess I'm tempted to go back in reverse order through the panel. So, James?
Great. I'm not sure what I can say usefully about return and
and the link to final status, I'm sure there is something to be said, but I would say one thing about final status, and that is that nobody, should think about it in any kind of a hurry. And one of the issues is that some people seem to want it to be, seem to think that it can be dealt with quickly, and that there will be a fast and rapid answer. And they all, those who think that tend also to assume they know exactly what that answer is going to be. I suspect there's a far more complex and therefore time-consuming process that's going to have to take place. And going back to the point that Julie made before, with which I agreed, I'll reinforce it in this context, and it plays to the return issue to some extent, I guess, is that there can be, whatever the final status is, it's, and if we're talking about the difference between independence and the absence of independent international personality, whichever it is, there's not going to be any final status until you have a political leadership which takes responsibility and which pursues governance in a way, which means that there will be a situation in which if somebody wanted to return, they could, and if they don't, they don't have to. And that's, it seems to me, that's the clear, simple message, which is once you've got the quality of governance in place for whatever it, that status is going to be, that issue will sort itself out to some extent. And I know life's not quite that simple and straightforward, but if you have that framework to begin with, then you can begin to see whether or not you can move forward. A range of questions from Mr. Peterson. I'm not sure quite how far we can get into all of them. I think the issue about the US domestic political situation is a bit of a canard as well. That's just the idea that that kind of thing might be there. But I've got, I can't say that I've spent my life at the heart of decision-making, but I've spent quite a bit of it floating around the edges of people thinking about these things, and they never do a single thing that they don't have to do, or that they don't absolutely feel that they have to do. And yeah, in that context, the idea that you would undertake something of this kind as a diversion from local political considerations in a democratic polity, I think is just so way out. People said the same thing about Operation Desert Fox over Iraq, that that was also supposed to be a diversionary measure. Well, I don't think that diverted so many people, because not many people even registered that it took place out there. There were other reasons for doing it. K4, failing to anticipate March. Well, okay. I think people did fail to anticipate March, and I think some people haven't yet completely settled on what they think March was. I made clear before, I think that some people in the Kosovo political quasi-military circles were involved in organizing the events, that they were not a set of spontaneous issues emerging. Some people think that they were. And some people think, well, we're not quite sure which it was. Whichever it was, I think you can't say that KFOR didn't respond, because some parts of KFOR got involved in firefights with people firing at them. I'll leave that. It's not like that. Back to the Milosevic. I don't agree with Dan that it was the prospect of 600,000 refugees that made Milosevic want to get out of war in Bosnia, but we agree completely that Milosevic wanted out of war in Bosnia, and he was very happy to have NATO air action to render General Mladic helpless, because my belief is that he'd already told General Mladic it was time to finish the war and to get out of it, and General Mladic still wasn't sure that whether or not he wanted to finish for what he thought he was doing in some parts of Bosnia, and it was very convenient that the NATO air action rendered Mladic helpless for the best part of 2 weeks, during which time he had to retreat to hospital, poor thing, in Belgrade, and came out not able to go forward to a peace process that was then going to be underway. So I think Milosevic wanted an agreement at Dayton. Milosevic didn't want an agreement at Rambouillet, and therein is the crucial difference between the two.
American narratives, I'm sure that would be a great thing to do as well. So, Charlie, if you're in the room, when all of this is over, if you want to start the next scholars initiative on the kind of Bushists versus anti-Bushists and various other American narratives, count us all in.
I think, Gilbert, you're next.
Yeah, it was a short question about the possibility of return and finance status. I think that's part of the standards, and somehow standards are part of the designing the finance status question. But in any case, I think it will help very much for those who want to return not to have contrast among two realities. I mean, they cannot come back into the different mental reality and to the different physical reality. I think it will help all of them who want to return and those who would like to live with them to accept and to reconcile these two concepts.
Yeah.
I will also make 2 points about status. I could not say final for some reasons, and also about KFOR. About status, you know, as the scientist, I'm really careful with the final status, which they are going on from final solution approaches. As the guy who is living in the Balkan, which is indeed, I would say, overlapped with the ethno-nationalistic movements, talking about final status means to talking about violence and ethnic cleansing as the instrument to solve the problem of building state. Nation-state building process. And the last, nothing will be final. You know, many people like me who were born in Yugoslavia, we were believed that Yugoslavia is final. But you know what's happened with them. If you think on independence of Kosovo as the highest level of the Albanian aspiration, it's okay, but it's not final. Who knows? But what I like to say, was wrong approach to divide the question of the past, today's and future. Nobody could manage his life or her life without knowing about the future. The question of the future status must to be open, must to be, how to say, start the process which will go to the solutions. That's one. The second, I must to say that I'm worried about the opening. The maximum, which according to my analysis could be reached now, is some general agreement between European Union and states about the framework and general direction. I will not now quote the name of the guy, but he is one of the most influential Albanian leader. He said to me, I know that they will do that, but that is not my problem. That's Rugova problem. Rugova promised independence. And for that, I told about security vacuum. I told about the risk in May, June. And the last about the KFOR. Everything is right. But about the KFOR and 17 March, or today, we could say too many soldiers. In Kosovo, we have around 18,000 soldiers. What soldiers could do with the micro security? Nothing special. They are able to do with the macro security. And they solve the problem. Not any chance to be the large armed conflict between Serbia, Serbs, Albanians, Macedonia. And for that, I think that the security package for Kosovo must to be rethinking. We need there more trained people, more specialists, for fighting against organized crime, terrorism, and violence, political violence. For that, I think there's this opportunity to make the one step ahead when we are talking about responsibility. You know, I'm in favor of the one idea calling the club of the joint responsibility, which will involve the local governments, Kosovo, Belgrade, Skopje, Tirana, Podgorica plus NATO and European Union, dealing, cooperating, fighting against organized crime and other risk, and the final. which is not a solution. This is not only Kosovo problem, this is a regional problem. And security and KFOR must be, I would say, adopted to the regional context. But it is welcome there, unfortunately.
Thank you, Dušan. Charlie and Grau had thought that we would take this session until 1:30 and take only 15 minutes for lunch. No. Oh, he has notes for you.
Yes.
Oh, because I was going to use your earlier notes. Okay. Let me. I was going to use some of Julie's earlier notes. She's been passing us notes like crazy as the closing, but I'm informed that she has also passed James some notes as her closing comments. But I wanted to assure those who are feeling the pangs of hunger that we are going to overrule Charlie Ingrau's effort to keep us sitting here until 1:30. We are just going to be here another couple of minutes, and then we'll take lunch and reconvene as scheduled at 1:45. So, James?
Okay. Right. So, Julie again. Regarding optimism over Kosovo, Julie's been working on Kosovo since 1992, always looking for ways to be optimistic, so very glad to hear reports of optimism. but you sensed the irony there, but she also says she's quite glad to hear, and she agrees that there is a lot to be optimistic about. The point she made on returns, which she says she would make in a far more nuanced way if she were herself, not myself, is that Serbs who don't want to return shouldn't be forced to return, and for those who do not want to return, there ought to be some framework and offer of compensation. And finally, on the final status question, she agrees with me, it's always a good thing, that nobody should be in a hurry. But she also says, however, we need to be responsive to the Kosovars' desire to get on with things on the civilian side while retaining the best, whatever that means, of the military side. And I think we would all agree with that. It's about making somewhere that works. And the final note on this being the final meeting of the Scholars Initiative here. First, history is not final, echoing Dushko, and secondly, with Charlie Ingrau and the support of USIP and NED, anything is possible.
Thank you very much. This is not our final session, however. We'll reconvene at 1:45 after having had some lunch and for a panel discussion moderated by Charlie.